Hi, this is Joe Francica, Editor-in-Chief of Directions Media. The following press briefing by General Jim Clapper, the Undersecretary for Defense Intelligence and the former Director of the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, was given at the GEOINT conference on October the 28th, 2008. Clapper clarifies some of the comments that he made on stage at the opening plenary session at GEOINT with regard to the change in administration, as well as the possibility of budget cuts within the intelligence community.
You were talking about this program in terms of did you want to get the next administration involving, could you explain that a little bit, involving the investment sector? I think that's what you were talking about.
Well, the one area I recall talking about in terms of teeing something up for the next administration, of course, you know, we're about that. That's one of the things we're doing right now, because I think from present on down, everyone was very committed to trying to make this as smooth and orderly a transition as we possibly can. So, and the things that we didn't get to or couldn't fix or think the next administration should look at, one of the areas writ large was the whole business of industrial interactions with foreign countries, which of course has a double-edged sword. On one hand, you want to engender partnerships and take advantage of technology wherever it comes from. On the other hand, there are security and counterintelligence equities that you have to attend to as well. So one of the things that I certainly intend to tee up is the recommendation that we look at this whole area of how we regulate technological interactions both ways, from us to foreign entities and vice versa. The whole issue of how we regulate foreign ownership of U.S. companies, which is, has been a growing trend, how we monitor that, not to interfere with positive business arrangements, but at the same time protecting U.S. Security equities. And it's a very, very complex issue. And for my part, don't think that we are probably not adequately postured to do that in light of the way the world works today, globalization and all that sort of thing. So that's one area. I'm not sure that's what you're alluding to, but that's one
that
area
is,
I did speak
yeah.
to about teeing up a recommendation for the next administration.
Just to follow up, are you suggesting a reform of the CFIUS system?
Well, no, I don't know that I don't know that anything needs to be changed or reformed. I just think it's something worth looking at in its totality. Actually, the CFIUS process works pretty well. And of course, the thing we attempt to do there is to wring out all the equities from not only Department of Defense and Intelligence Committee, but others who have an interest in it as well, Commerce, Treasury, State. So that's, from what I've seen of it, it's a pretty good process. Yes.
General, what are your personal thoughts on the BASIC program? Do we need it, and why?
Well, I think, yes, we do need, you know, what the area of the architecture, you know, that we went to this four-tier architecture, and so the notion of, you know, wide area coverage that tailored primarily to support military requirements, but can satisfy other requirements as well. That portion of the architecture does need to be addressed. Now, you know, how we're going to do it. BASIC was, that was one approach which we thought had merit, since it would involve getting up a couple of satellites that were, you know, known technology, low risk, we felt, and we could do it fairly quickly. And for lots of reasons, which I can and won't go into, that that just didn't pan out. But I think the requirement is still there, and the Congress has mandated that the DNI will look at that and just what's the way forward.
In your mind, were there any barriers for doing fulfilling the BASIC requirements with commercial capabilities?
Well, I think commercial, I obviously was a huge proponent of commercial imagery when I was director of NGA. I think what's the commercial buys right now from the two companies are pretty substantial. The government's invested in the future system, and I'm confident we'll continue to do that. So yes, there's clearly a role for commercial imagery. In an unclassified environment, it is invaluable in sharing in both the coalition environment overseas or domestically in the support to any number of contingencies, you know, disasters, Rita, Katrina, that sort of thing. So commercial imagery has proven its great worth. So there's always going to be a place for that.
Yeah. A couple budget questions. You alluded to in your presentation potential cuts in satellite programs over the next decade.
Generally speaking, and in fact, Rich Haver spoke to this in his introductory remarks, comparing, harking back, and he's right, to similar periods in our history in the past. And I was around as director of DIA at the time when the fall of the wall, and we were under a lot of pressure to reduce. We had to reap the peace dividend, and so I think we're probably confronting a similar, an analogous era now with an administration, and I think the intelligence community is going to be in for a period of some stricture. That said, though, I think regardless who wins, there is a recognition, I believe, on the part of both potential administrations that intelligence is going to have to play a huge role in, you know, safety and security of the nation. So I don't expect the degree to which we had to reduce after the fall of the wall, which of course created a lot of bathtubs for us, both from a standpoint of manpower. As Rich alluded, the way we did the reduction then was through attrition, and then we created a generational gap for ourselves, which we're only now we're beginning to recover from, with the hiring upswing with personnel that has recovered from that bathtub. So I hope we can remember, if we're confronted with we, next administration, I say that collectively, the collective we, that we can remember lessons learned and take how on how we managed or not the previous such iteration when after the Cold War.
Just one follow-up, but the DNI announced today that the 08 budget for all the NTIP programs was $47.5 billion,
right,
a 9% over the 07. So are you talking this budget may be a high watermark?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it could be. You know, it's the Congress giveth and taketh away. So that's, in the end, that's ultimately up to the Congress to decide how much money will be out of the nation's wealth and treasure will be allocated to national intelligence. So I'd be surprised, frankly, if it got increased over that in future budgets. My own assessment is that may be a high watermark for a while. So we may see a downturn, which, if you look at our history, has been sort of the cyclical pattern.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Would you consider serving in a new administration, whichever camp wins?
Well, I'm a duty guy at heart. You know, I've come and gone, retired twice and come back. And, you know, if somebody asked me to stay, I'd certainly consider it. On the other hand, if you say you're out of here, that's okay too. I've been doing this for 45 years, so, you know, it's maybe time to move on.
Ask my real question now. This $1.4 billion additional money for ISR capabilities, is it clear how much...
You're speaking of the ISR task force money?
Yes, the ISR task force money, right.
Mm-hmm.
How much of that is devoted to Afghanistan, and, you know, how much is devoted to Iraq?
That's an excellent question, and the answer is... to be determined. What the ISR task force, which is now underway, kind of phase two, is to generate capability. How it's allocated, that capability is allocated between the two theaters, is yet to be determined. And I think General Petraeus, now the new commander to be of CENTCOM, will have a lot to say about that. So, but I think that it's a great question, and my answer to it is that the ISR task force challenge is to generate the capability. from the industrial base to fielding, and where those things fall out of the spigot, whether they fall out in Iraq or fall out in Afghanistan, that's a TBD.
Well, it's interesting that
time for difficult
form. Well, let me not monopolize, but you know, it's interesting then because you would think, I mean, this IRS, our task force is buying things. So what if you don't need the same thing you need in Afghanistan as you bought in
Iraq? Well, that's very true. And there are some things just because of the terrain and the operating conditions in Afghanistan and the fact that you have a much lighter force there, much more international capacity and all that. That's very true. That has some bearing on it. But I think at this point we are in the mode of generating as much generic capability as we possibly can. And do the plug and play and modules that you can hang on airframes and that sort of take off so that it can be adaptable or adjustable and it's not hardwired just for one theater.
Thank you.
I can take a more.
I just wanted to clarify because you were talking about earlier about the budget and about how this is, things go cyclically and you were saying that comparing it to when the wall fell, but obviously we have two wars going on, we always have the threat of terrorism, and I'm wondering Why would you think that people would cut the budget?
Well, I don't. I guess I mean I don't know. I'm simply guessing. I have no insight in all this,
right.
And that will be, I think, a function of what the new administration, regardless of who wins, how they want to allocate priorities. We have a lot of other challenges today, not the least of which is the huge economic crisis and all that that's going to have to be dealt with. Healthcare reform, Social Security reform, yada, yada, yada. You know, the list goes on. So
a lot of
intelligence, obviously, I'm never met intelligence capability I didn't love, but that's only part of the broader context of demands on the budget, and so my sensing is, and I that's strictly instinctive, is that I think we're probably in for a period of some retrenchment. I may not be to the magnitude that we attempted or what was thrust on us after the end of the Cold War, but I think we're in for something of that order. Any other?
You mentioned that there's a huge dearth in the training, a generational gap in the experience of people. What's being done, and at what level? Where are you going to put the emphasis in terms of education and training?
Well, I can cite a case in point since I happen to recall the statistics when I was director of NGA, and the experience level, the average experience level, the typical workstation analyst, imagery analyst, declined from, say, an average of about, if I recall the numbers, around 13 years to 4 years. So that's reflective of the generational change and the infusion of lots and lots of young people, or people, I shouldn't say young people necessarily, but people that don't have the experience, because we also got a lot of people, which I think is a good thing, into second careers and all that, but new to the business. So that's one thing, there might have been other things, but that's one thing I never spent a lot of time lying awake at night worrying about. Because what I found, and I continue to see evidence of that in this job, that whatever is lacking in the way of experience is made up for by IT smarts, the computer fluency that today's young people have that people of my generation don't. So they make up for it with their smarts, their commitment, and their dedication. And also, a lot of the experience that we had maybe that didn't necessarily apply. So I think the fact that we've had a huge infusion of younger people or inexperienced people is a good thing. One of the ways we, at least at NGA, and I'm sure it's continued, and I think it's emblematic of the whole community, is we have spent a lot of time and effort and investment in improving our training. I know we certainly did that at NGA. And the other thing is, which I think is a small unsung program, which is the selective use of retired annuitants, bring them back as mentors and godfathers and godmothers for a lot of these young people. I know we did that on a selective basis at NGA, and that worked very effectively. So there's a lot of things. There's no one silver bullet here. We're going through a huge evolution with language training, which has become a big deal because of the requirement for the whole plethora of Middle East languages. So a lot of focus, a lot of emphasis on that as well. And of course the challenge you have in trying to generate fluency in some of these more exotic languages, Pashto, Dari, et cetera, which is a tough challenge. Yeah.
I feel what an outrage supporting the search, the intelligence community support to the search. Mm-hmm. General Petraeus has talked in some detail about the blending of mass and SIGINT and all the hints at the commander level that for these special mission units they go after Al Qaeda. At the broad level, can you give a feel for the assets that were brought to bear in
the
search?
At the broad level, of course, as I alluded in my remarks, what's happened here is on a very time sensitive basis is the correlation and synthesis of all the intelligence discipline in a very rapid way. First, in the prosecution of high-value targets, but the philosophy of doing that has now spread to the so-called white-soft world, and for that matter, to the conventional forces. So the result has been, in recognition of that, this emerging voracious appetite, to use a cliche, for all forms of ISR to support the whole range of operations go on, whether they're conducted by soft forces or conventional forces. And so it's been, kind of a revolution. You know, I think back to the day in my war, which is Southeast Asia, and I spent two tours, combat tours, in intelligence as early as 1965 in Vietnam, and there is no comparison between what we're able to do now in intelligence perspective. For automation in the day then when I was a lieutenant was acetate and grease pencil and two corporals. And now what we're able to do, what we're able to portray, the data we're able to move. I served as Chief Air Force Intelligence during Desert Storm.
Right.
And even since Desert Storm, the improvements and enhancements that we have made in this whole arena of what we now call ISR, a term that didn't exist then, has been phenomenal. Now, yeah, there's always issues and problems, and you can always make it better and all that, but again, now that I've achieved intelligence geezerdom, I can reflect back over 4.5 decades of this business, and there's a lot of progress. And what we're doing in Iraq and Afghanistan is kind of the epitome of this. And one of the, as I alluded, the characteristics that's, I think, reflective of this change and the importance of and reliance on ISR is the fluency that the commanders have with this. Four stars, two-star division commanders, brigade commanders, they all understand how this works. And the reason is, it's not because it's cool, but because they got to do it, they got to have it for their mission.
But at the 30,000 level, what's some of the output? I mean, is it then an exponential number of Al-Qaeda or Hezbollah killed?
You read the media releases about high-value targets that we take down, but there's another layer that below that the same techniques, tactics, and procedures that are used for a whole lot of other things, and it, of course now what we're doing, as I alluded in my remarks, is trying to impart that approach to the Iraqis so they can be self-sufficient on their own, and we take more of a supportive advisory role and less of an activist operational role.
I have a question that sort of goes to that. You mentioned Iraqi soft forces not having the ISR enablers they need. I'm wondering how that would affect any kind of drawdown plan.
Well, it would have a big impact, and that's one of the things we're wrestling with right now. Of course, a lot of this is dependent on the SOFA, the Status of Forces Agreement, and how that plays out, and the requirements that we would have for entering into a formal intelligence exchange with the Iraqis, and there are certain legal requirements that we need them to sign up to. But in the meantime, I think there's a lot we can do in the training arena, and we are to prepare them so that more and more they can grow their own organic capabilities.
Can you talk a little bit about Afghanistan? There's going to be the NIE coming out, and news reports have said that the situation is dire, and I'm wondering if you could just talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think that's a little bit melodramatic hyperbole to say it's dire. clearly, it's been an economy of force operation there. Afghanistan is much larger than Iraq, and it has much, much more demanding terrain than does Iraq. So there are a number of factors there that are different. But I don't think I'd characterize it as dire. There are clearly some big challenges there, and I think that's the reason for the review, to see this is a good thing to tee up for the next administration. And they will have the benefit of both the NIE and the policy review, and have some recommendations to deal with when they take office.
Do you feel that you have enough intelligence people then?
Well, you never have enough. I mean, ideally, you'd always want more intelligence, more resources. So, if you ask the commander out there, he would say, I need more, which they always do. Get the hook?
Okay.
If the NIE is not dire...
Let's do one last question here, Phil.
If the NIE is not... If dire is one immediate characterization, can you give...
That's my own characterization, though.
Can you give a more nuanced...
As nuanced as I can get here, which is we have some big challenges there just because of the political situation. You have the issue of drugs there, yeah, and the terrain and... the dispersion of forces and all those kind of things, I just wouldn't pick the word dire. Okay?
Thank you.